sure hope you're hungry. Ooh, I'm starving. Wash those hands, pull up a chair, and secure that feed bag. Because it's time to listen to Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss attempt to use human language to converse with and pick the brains of other developers. I thought there was going to be food. So buckle up and grab that O-shit handle, because this ride is going to get wild. This is the Syntax Supper Club.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. We've got another banger supper club for you today. We have somebody who has, I'm going to admit it, a cooler name than I have. Dax Rad is on today to talk about, I think we're just going to be talking mostly about serverless, hosting Next.js Anywhere. He's behind a couple different projects, SST as well as Open Next.js. We're excited to talk all about that. Welcome, Dax. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. We're sponsored today by Sentry. Let's talk about their new APM. What is APM? Application Performance Monitor. So what that will do is you throw it in your application and it's sort of trying to monitor things that will make your website slow. We had a show a couple days ago about slow websites and what could possibly cause it. So what Sentry will do is it will detect common things, large render blocking assets, slow database queries, file IO on the main thread. That's probably not something you want to do. You know, in Node, you have that write file sync, which is that will block up your main thread, and anything else running on that main thread will not be able to go until you've actually finished writing that file. So that could be a big no-no. You're going to want to check it out. There's lots in this APM, and I'm sure I'll go into the features of it over the next couple ad reads. You want to check it out at sentry.io. Use the coupon code TASTYTREAT for 2 months for free. Also want to check out their blog post, which is the new APM, actionable, affordable, and actually built for developers. Thank you, Sentry, for sponsoring. We'll start this by just saying 2023, I said, is my year for AWS. So I've been looking at some of my server bills and whatnot, and I say, like, man, this is real expensive to be able to do this stuff. And then I look over at AWS and I go, that's too hard. And I'm stuck in this like position of like something is very expensive and obviously easy versus something that is, I think, cheaper. We'll see. But it's just like, there's so many pieces to it. So we're trying to like this year, we're trying to get a little bit more into AWS and understand all the different parts and whatnot. So you're the first person that we're having on to sort of talk about that type of stuff. Let's talk about, you want to give like a quick rundown of who you are and what you do. And then I thought we'll get into the Open Next.js stuff first, and then we'll get into the SST stuff.
Yeah, sounds good. So again, my name is Dax. I work entirely on open source. It's a pretty lucky situation that I'm in. Wow. The primary project that I work on is called SST. It's a framework that helps people like yourself start to build things on AWS without fully being exposed to the monstrosity that is AWS. Because like you said, there's a lot of great reasons to be building on AWS, especially for things that are a little bit more serious and as you start to get to a certain scale. But it's pretty unapproachable for the average person. So our job is to really go dig through all the AWS docs, read everything, figure out all the little weird quirks, and then expose something that makes a lot more sense for the end user, figure out what kind of rough edges there are on their day-to-day development cycles, and make all that smoother.
I'll start this with a question. I went down this rabbit hole the other day. I put a tweet out where I logged into AWS, and I looked at some of the profiles I had created, and one of them was 12 years old. And I tweeted, has it gotten any better in about 12 years? And half the people are like, no, and half the people are yes. So I was like, I just want to deploy a serverless function raw to AWS. And I like got into it, and like there's no build pipeline, and there's all these products. Why does AWS not have something like Netlify or Vercel, or like, why don't they have that? And like, why is there all these businesses built up on top of AWS being easier?
The thing is, AWS does think they have that, and they have like three or four attempts at building something like Netlify or Vercel or Heroku or whatever. I think, I forgot who it was, someone documented all different ways to deploy a container, and there's like something crazy, like 18 different ways that you can do it, because they represent all these attempts at AWS trying to create a higher level like abstraction for to make some of these things simpler. I just don't think it's in their DNA. They are an infrastructure hyperscaler company. They're about deploying like a crazy amount of physical hardware across the whole world, have it working. That is really far removed to what a developer experiences day to day when they're trying to build something. I think it's an awkward fit for them culturally.
Interesting.
Yeah. It does feel like that's been a long time thing forever. I mean, even into Amazon.com itself, they've never had the polish, I think, in the UI department that many other companies have. And that does seem to turn off people from AWS. And like you mentioned, Wes, it opens up the door for all these other businesses that are built on top of AWS just to make it easier on folks, right? So do you think it's a positive thing that AWS hasn't figured this out because it enables all these other companies to exist? Or do you think they'll get there eventually?
Yeah, I think for me, I find myself in a tricky situation because I'll be trying to do something at AWS. I'll be really frustrated and I'll wish that it was better, and I'll be annoyed with the teams behind certain services that are creating these problems. And then I'll realize, oh, well, if they were actually doing all those things, I wouldn't really have a job. So I definitely appreciate the gap that it creates. I think it is like a good system. AWS's scope is just massive. They're trying to serve every possible business out there. And the reality is, to build good services, you do have to narrow your scope a lot. And a lot of these companies that people like Vercel or Netlify, their scope is a lot narrower in terms of what they try to offer and who they try to serve than what AWS can do. And that's kind of why they have a good product. And I think there's a reality of it where at the scope that AWS has, you just can't really build anything that great.
All right, let's get into the open Next.js stuff. So Next.js, huge, probably the largest React framework for building a website out there. It sort of encompasses a lot. And it is obviously very tightly, not tightly, but it's the baby of Vercel. And Vercel is this amazing hosting platform that does images and CDN and caching and deploy previews and serverless and edge functions. And they do all the stuff. And the like experience of writing an Next.js app and hosting it on Vercel is a very, very nice experience. We host that's the exact stack and hosting platform we use for the Syntax website. But there's often been people saying, well, it's not that easy to host a Next.js site anywhere else. They provide some outlets and whatnot. So do you want to give us like a rundown of like what is the Open Next.js project?
Yeah, so I think the premise is, like you said, Next.js hosted on Vercel is an incredible experience. And trying to host it in other places, you kind of have a variety of different options and variety of different experiences you can have. So you can self-host Next.js in a container. It's pretty easy for Vercel to support that because it's just a long-running process that can literally just do everything that they needed to do. But for a lot of people, self-hosting Next.js in a container is pretty different than what they get from Vercel. Just in terms of costs, you have something that's always running. It's a lot more expensive to have like global availability, things like that, when you have to deploy containers everywhere. When most people think of, I want to self-host Next.js, they expect it to be entirely serverless, deploying to functions and kind of serverless primitives that AWS offers. And the process for doing that isn't actually straightforward. I'm not going to say Vercel like explicitly doesn't let you do that. They actually do put in a lot of effort in creating standard outputs so that you can take a Next.js app and potentially get it to be self-hosted in AWS. But the gap there of what you get from that build output to actually deploying is pretty massive. You need to, one, be an expert in AWS. You really need to understand the different ways you can do things. You also need to understand pretty like detailed internals of Next.js, understand the different components that Next actually offers. And there's not just a single way you can deploy to AWS. There's a lot of different ways you can deploy with different trade-offs. Some functionality just cannot work in an entirely AWS environment. It's really difficult and takes a lot of man hours to just figure that out. Mm-hmm. So that's why we started the Open Next project, because there were a lot of kind of disparate efforts at doing this. we had there's like an older project called Serverless Next.js that a lot of companies were using. In fact, AWS even used to use this open source project internally to power their Next.js offering. Of course, like one person cannot maintain that long term. That project kind of died. And there are kind of a few offshoots of trying to do this. And there was enough interest in our community of people wanting to run Next.js in AWS where we avoided building this project for a while. We really didn't want to do it just because it's a lot of work. But we got to a point where there was enough expertise in the community for us to actually go ahead and build that.
So how many people are involved in an effort like this?
Yeah, so from our core team, we have Frank, who pretty much leads this effort. He spends a lot of time on this. There is a little bit of upfront work, you know, to get to a place where there is one-to-one parity with what Vercel offers. And then from there, it's more maintenance. And then in terms of help in the community, I think we have like five or six people that are pretty much talking about this all day. None of us at SST are actually Next.js users, which is kind of funny because we're the ones that are behind this effort. So we're not experts in the details of how Next.js should work or its exact features. We really rely on our community to, you know, report how things are working and what things aren't exactly right. And they find a lot of really obscure things. Like they'll figure out, oh, we need to pass this explicit header for like this very specific feature to work, things like that.
Let's move through the different parts of Next.js and we'll sort of like map those to what are the Amazon products. So at its very core, Next.js splits its routes. So every time you go to a URL, it makes that into a serverless function. Is that right?
So not exactly. So the build output outputs a single function that handles all of your routes. So that means it's all bundled into like one like kind of fat Lambda function. And then they do have, you know, their edge function concept, which is a little bit separate.
Okay. So literally every single route is all bundled into one app and run on one serverless function. Because I remember when Vercel was it now? And they moved away from Node. Mm-hmm. And I had an Express app running on Node. And they're like, yeah, just throw it in a Lambda function. And it's like that it doesn't fit. Like it's way too large for that type of thing. So like, is there a hard limit? I always thought, for some reason, I thought that they split it up per URL. So they're literally throwing your entire application, backend API routes and everything into one serverless function?
Well, so I suspect what Vercel does internally might be a little bit different than the build output that the open source Next.js produces. So yeah, you're right. Bundling everything to a single function is not great long-term. If you have one dependency on one route that is really large, suddenly that's hitting the cold starts of like all the routes in your application. So I suspect that Next.js or Vercel might, when they deploy onto their platform, they might do some kind of splitting. It's challenging. It's easy with stuff like API routes. Like API routes split nicely. But it is a little bit trickier with UI routes than Nest, and especially with the new app layout stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That always got me, not just on Next.js, but in general, where it's like, yeah, you put everything into your own and every single route has its own package JSON. And that's annoying to me because I was like, I don't want every package JSON for every single function. And then other people say, well, okay, now you have the special package, that shared code, and you can put anything you want in there, that shared code. But then I'm like, well, okay, now I have to decide, can I just put it where I want it? And it will like figure it out from there. And I'm assuming, maybe that's what Vercel does on their end, is they do a bunch of tree shaking or whatnot to make the functions as small as possible. Because nice and small, that deploys super quick, you get nice cold starts. It's really sweet when that stuff does work.
Yeah, and that's a pattern that we actually encourage. So our main framework, SST, we talk about something similar. You don't want to, you don't want to think about it as like these complete, discrete, separate things. You want to build like one big application. And at deploy time, you want it to be broken down and tree shaking and all that. And that's the exact pattern we like, and that's what we encourage. Because yeah, thinking that granularly when you're building something is just kind of annoying.
Mm-hmm. And then the Next.js has a concept of middleware, and those are deployed to the edge. Can you give us a quick rundown? We've talked about it on the show a few times, but I'm sure people are still not really familiar. What is the edge?
Yeah, so this one is really tricky. So the reason this is tricky for us to implement is Vercel itself runs primarily on AWS. So when you run a function on Next.js, or sorry, on Vercel. I keep getting these two confused. on Vercel, it runs in AWS. But a lot of their edge stuff is powered by Cloudflare. So when the middleware runs at the edge, it's not running in an AWS data center. It's running in a Cloudflare data center. And Cloudflare data centers, there's a lot more of them, and they're closer to the end user. And they're less capable, but good enough to run things like middleware. So a big challenge for us is, okay, if you want to self-host all of Next.js, including the middleware, we have to deploy that middleware inside AWS. And that means, you know, there's different constraints that we have to abide by that Vercel does not. Because they can pick whatever architecture they want.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually kind of nice if you go to a vendor and they say, you know what, we'll figure it out for you. We'll make it fast. So the limitations we're talking about with edge functions, and this is true for running in Dino, in Cloudflare Workers, in there's a couple other runtimes we've talked about, is that it's not a Node.js environment. It's a JavaScript web environment, and you only have a certain set of APIs available to you. So I converted a tiny little site the other day, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to run it on Netlify Edge, which is, it runs in Dino. So you can't use any Node.js APIs unless Dino supports them and large packages and whatnot. So there's like a little bit of a limitation, but the upside is what? It's much faster and quicker to load, and they literally deploy them to hundreds of different server locations around the world?
Yeah, exactly. So if you look at traditional Lambda functions on AWS, they're not opinionated about what language you use. You can use a variety of different languages that they support natively. You can bring your own custom runtime for languages you want. And that constrains their architecture. They have to build a functions platform for running any arbitrary code. Some of these edge platforms like Cloudflare, it's all about narrowing scope. Whenever you narrow scope, you can really up the quality. They're saying you can not only just, you're constrained not only to JavaScript, but a very specific flavor of the runtime that we provide. It's good enough for most things. If you accept these constraints, we can do some really interesting things. And one of those things is basically zero cold start. Their billing on the Cloudflare Edge's billing is pretty incredible. Let me see if I can explain this. So if you only pay for compute time, that means if your function starts, compute some stuff, then makes a network request and it waits like 500 milliseconds to the network request, you're not actually being billed for that waiting time. You're only billed when the network request comes back and you're, you know, using the CPU again. And that creates it's a really simple concept, but it creates so many things and so many opportunities for things you can build that, you know, isn't exactly possible on a traditional functions platform.
I remember seeing that because I remember looking at the like 10 milliseconds or something like that on Cloudflare Workers. I was like, that's not enough. And then like who's possibly running code in 10 milliseconds and that's it. But I've never hit that. I've never hit the issue. And somebody explained to me, no, it's not. If you're fetching a big thing that Cloudflare Workers is really good at is proxying web pages. So if you're going to nba.com and downloading all of the HTML and then waiting for it to come back, you're not paying for that time. And that's wild. Like, how do they just not charge you for it, or do they literally spin it down while you're waiting for that?
Yeah. So technically they are not paying for, like, your function is off the CPU at that point. It's just waiting for the network hardware to say, hey, it's done downloading. I have a payload for you. So there still is like a memory cost for them, but the CPU cost is what's limited. So they can have other customers running on that CPU while you're waiting for your request to come back. And that's how they basically sell the same second multiple times to multiple people. And it's a model that can work really well at scale.
Wow. And that's another thing that people don't often understand, is that, like, if you look at pricing for a lot of these things, they charge you by compute hour. Just regular people look at it and go, like, how do I do that? Do you have any like tips on like how would you calculate that type of thing? Or is it just you got to see?
Pricing is a funny thing in the serverless world. It's pretty much in hindsight. And I would say, I think people try to come up with ways to figure out costs ahead of time. I think the reality is you don't know the costs ahead of time. It's more around shifting your mindset around what your costs are. I think we're used to paying for things in a monthly way. You know, like if you think about our personal lives, we pay monthly bills. But when it comes to cloud infrastructure and things involving your business, I think it's better to think about it as marginal cost, where you just need to make sure that you are charging someone else more than what your marginal cost is. So if to serve one request, it costs you a penny, make sure you're charging 10 cents for that. That way, it doesn't matter what your monthly bill is, because if you scale up 100x, your margin still makes sense, right? You're never going to go negative as long as you're thinking about like the unit economics there. But it is tricky. Like the pricing is not intuitive, and it's not even compute hour now. It's like per millisecond. Like, how many milliseconds are you going to use this month? It's not really something that you can really guess. You kind of look at it in hindsight and see what's what.
Can it be like incredibly cheap to run stuff on this as well, though?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of confusion around pricing. I think I've heard people instinctively say serverless stuff is really expensive. I've also heard people instinctively say that it's not expensive. In practice, it's insanely cheap, and the numbers and the way you compute the numbers are a little bit counterintuitive, which is why people might perceive them as being expensive. But it is like unbelievably cheap. Like, I don't think I've had a bill more than like $5 or something. And I run some stuff that gets like serious traffic. And I think the culture, at least with AWS, is they have never raised prices ever. There's some services that are now 99% cheaper than they were when they launched. They know that the moment that they leave room, that someone else is going to come in and offer a cheaper service. So you'll just see prices go down and down and down. I say one of my favorite examples of this is Lambda. Let me see if I can remember the exact numbers. So they used to charge per 100 milliseconds. So if you had a request that took 20 milliseconds, you were being charged for 100 milliseconds. Then one day they came out and they said, okay, we're now going to charge you per millisecond. That means your costs are now 80% cheaper overnight without you doing anything. And there's a million examples of this. And I think people kind of worry about with all these, you know, very cloud native services, am I going to get trapped and like they're going to jack the price up and I'm going to be screwed? Historically, at least with like this modern set of companies, they understand the mistakes of the previous generation of companies that try to do that. And they know that, you know, they got to make sure prices keep going down.
I'll give you another example of I host my course platform on Render as a long-running node app. And I've been really looking at moving it over to serverless lately because I have pull request previews on my pull request. And I had a pull request sitting there for 3 or 4 months. It's just I wasn't ready to deal with it. And then I had 3 or 4 running for a couple of weeks. And then I realized like every single pull request is another VM that is spun up and run until I merge the pull request. Mm-hmm. And if your regular VM costs $10 a month, and then you have 6 more pull requests running at $10 each a month, that gets out of hand really quickly. And the obvious answer is merge them quick. It's cheaper to do that. But I thought like, man, if this was serverless functions, it literally would not run until I click the URL and that thing will spin up again.
Yeah, and that's kind of why some of these costs are counterintuitive. It's easy to think about just a very narrow version of your production environment. Like think about like one container running mm-hmm. production, but that container has to be at least reasonably highly available. Then you have like your dev environments and you have your pull request environments and all these add up. And it's not just your compute part of it. It's can you pay for your database in a serverless way? If you can, then you can have a separate database for each pull request environment and it's costing you nothing. So we see a lot of people coming to serverless specifically for the developer environments and the pull request environments.
What about images and assets? So I know Next.js has really nice image component that will let you resize on the fly. Is that type of thing something you can also do in the serverless world?
Yeah, so their standard build outputs a function that can do that. And we just deploy that as another serverless function. And that part actually works pretty nicely out of the box. I think the thing with that is there's not anything specific to your application, like that image resizing and all those tools are like a generic solution, right? You just pass in, it's just going to pass in the image that you need and handle the resizing. So that is something that we support in the self-hosted version. And yeah, it's like sitting behind a CDN and all of that. So it's optimized.
Awesome. And the CDN is, so Cloudflare, or sorry, not Cloudflare.
CloudFront.
CloudFront and S3, right? Is it using both of those?
Yeah, so when we build your Next.js app, there's a few things that it spits out. There's a bunch of static files that don't change, and those get uploaded to S3. That gets put behind a CDN, which is CloudFront. Your functions actually get put behind the CDN as well. And there's also, so your functions for your main application, We also deploy some edge functions. So AWS does support edge functions, and those actually like live in the same environment as the CDN. We deploy edge functions there for the Next.js middleware stuff.
So I'm actually looking at, I primarily use Svelte and SvelteKit myself, and they have this adapter situation where you can have an output adapter. I found basically the SvelteKit adapter AWS CDK, and they have very similar diagrams to kind of what you have going on, right? You have the S3 buckets, you have CloudFronts for the CDN and the static assets for an S3 bucket. Is the CDK a layer on top of something that Amazon is doing, or is that just a name for how you develop cloud applications locally?
Yeah, so when you start looking at AWS, you realize it's just like crazy amount of layers. So let me see if I can trace this all the way down. AWS has a infrastructure as code tool called CloudFormation. All this means is instead of going into the AWS UI, clicking a bunch of things to configure something, you can do this all in this YAML specification. It's terrible. Nobody should be using it. Everyone hates using it. So they built a layer that compiles to CloudFormation called CDK. And CDK is, so instead of writing YAML, you can write types. I have a lot of issues with CDK. They optimize it so you can write it in a variety of different languages like TypeScript, Python, I think Java, Go, a few others, and all compiles down into this CloudFormation YAML. 99% of people, I think, are just using it in TypeScript. So I just wish they just optimized for TypeScript. There are some trade-offs when you try to make something multi-language. And so today, a modern application on AWS, I think CDK is a pretty good option. A lot of people are still using CloudFormation directly just because they have the experience with it. And SST, the thing that we build, is actually built on top of CDK. So we have a lot of experience with using CDK and some of the internals there.
So if somebody opts to use CDK, are they opting into paying for that as a bit more of a service, or are you still paying just for the underlying services?
Yeah, so there's no charges associated with CloudFormation. So it's just a way for you to deploy stuff.
Yeah, like so we had a while back, we had Brian LaRue from Begin, which they seem to be switching gears a little bit, which is kind of interesting. But so he runs a project called Architect, which is at arc.code. And that it's your infrastructure as code, and that will compile to a CloudFormation. And it's funny, there's lots of people building it on top. So we talk about that. I'll talk about one more, and then let's get into what SST is. So there's another one that people keep recommending to me, and that's Terraform. Are you familiar with that? Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so Terraform is another infrastructure as code tool that is not tied to any specific cloud provider. I actually am a huge fan of the Terraform ecosystem. I used to build everything in Terraform, maybe for like 4 or 5 years before I moved to working on SST. Their interface is, it's not YAML, but it is a similar configuration language. I would say it's a lot better than YAML. But you can basically configure anything in it. You can configure stuff in AWS. You can configure stuff in Cloudflare. You can like make it turn on a light in your house. Like you can kind of use it for literally anything. And it's basically a way to describe the state of any system and have it, you know, retain that state and make changes to it over time. It's a great like neutral open source tool that's not tied to any one specific vendor. And we're actually looking, not anytime soon, but long-term, we would like to be more built on top of Terraform than built on top of CDK, just so we have access to some of the larger ecosystem.
Yeah.
All right. So you've talked about SST quite a bit, but like, let's give us a 30-second, 1 minute rundown of what it is and why are you building this?
Yeah. So the premise here is, like I said earlier, AWS is actually a great choice for most companies building products that they're trying to sell to other people. It's just extremely hard to understand anything going on in AWS. You're not really going to understand it through the console, the documentation. There's a ton of stuff to learn before you can even know the right way to do something. So the idea here is, let's build a framework that is our idea of the best way to build an application on AWS. So we don't cover all of AWS. I would say we cover maybe like 2% of AWS, which is probably the 2% that most people need. We focus just on the serverless services, and we provide high-level constructs, things like APIs, databases, you know, stuff like cron jobs, queues, long-running jobs, scheduled events, things like that, that are high-level pieces that you need for most applications that you can just spin up and configure and then, you know, access in your application code. Our scope is pretty broad. You know, we'll cover stuff that is very infrastructure related like that. We'll also cover rough edges that show up in your application. Like I said, we're doing the OpenNext stuff, so we help you deploy your front end, say AWS as well. We just want to make it really viable for you to start a project on day one on AWS without doing all this work of understanding it and research. But, you know, as your company grows, as your product grows, day 100, day 1000, you're still built on AWS, so you're not going to really need to eject out into something else. So that the idea is, you know, keep it simple in the beginning, but it's going to stick. It's going to be able to stick with you for the long run.
Nice. And if you're out there and you hear 2% of AWS, you think that's not very much, just go ahead to services in the top left of AWS, click all services and just start scrolling. And then by tomorrow, you'll hit the bottom of it.
Yeah, exactly. They have a lot of stuff and you eventually will need some of it. Yeah.
Is this something that you would pick up before you start an application? Or is, I know you have adapters for frameworks, but then I'm looking at the docs and there's also, like, if I want to just have a raw request coming in from a URL, does it have a router? Like, where does this fit in? Do I build on top of this or do I take my existing app and put it into it?
Yeah, so we have two different options. For most people, we would recommend if you're starting fresh, you start with a fresh SSE project. It sets you up for something that will work for a pretty long time. And you can configure that with, I just want an API or I have an API plus a GraphQL thing, or I have, you know, an Next.js app. You can kind of configure however you want. And we kind of think of that as that's an SST app that you're building. We also have something called drop-in mode, which we're releasing kind of framework by framework. We did a launch for Astro a few weeks ago, and we're doing one for Next.js next week. Basically, you have an existing Astro app, you have an existing Next.js app, whatever it is. You just want to like drop this in and get this deployed in AWS. You're not really trying to build a fully fledged SSE application. That basically requires you to just drop in a single file and, you know, you can deploy everything you have to AWS.
Oh, cool. And what about like a local dev experience? That's one thing that always makes me nutsy is that like, okay, I can run this thing locally, but then I have a whole nother set of whatever and trying to replicate
the rules,
the local environment. Such a pain. Like, do you solve that pain?
So that's actually where SSE started. And that's kind of how I even found the project. I was first getting into serverless. And like you said, the first question I had was like, how the hell do I do local development when everything is in the cloud? And I was building like my own like crappy solution to this. And I found SSE, which had just come out at that time. And they launched with a really kind of like a single feature. It was live Lambda debugging. And the idea here is the recommended setup we have for building like these AWS native systems is most of the stuff you do want remotely. Like your database running remotely is great. Like your queues running remotely is great. The thing that sucks is when you make a change in your function code, you don't want to wait for it to upload to AWS, which can take like 5 seconds to then like have the whole feedback loop. So SST originally had this brilliant idea of let's deploy 99% of your application for real because you're not changing it that frequently. But for functions, let's deploy a fake function. And when a request hits that function, we're going to forward it to your local machine, execute it locally, and then send the response back. So what that means is when you make changes, instead of waiting 5 seconds for the update, it's like however fast the ES build can run. So like a 50 millisecond response time. So we really originally started with figuring out how to make the local development experience really good. And since then, we've added a bunch of things around this to solve other rough edges. But today, when you do SST dev, which basically brings up your SST app in local mode, it feels like a normal locally running app with all the benefits of most of it running in cloud. And there's not much difference when you deploy to production. It's pretty much the exact same environment as what you had in the dev mode.
Oh, that's cool. And do you do any, I don't know if you said this or not, does SST do edge functions as well?
Yeah, so we don't have native contract. So SST offers like a set of like native SST contracts. We don't have one yet for edge functions, but you can drop down into CDK and deploy an edge function yourself. It's just a little more complicated and not as nice as the other SST constructs, but we probably will support this eventually.
Yeah, that's one thing I've always been wondering about, like, is like, what does the local development environment look like for developing edge functions? Because you need to constrain the thing. If you run it in Node, then someone's going to accidentally import a Node app and then it doesn't work and then you deploy it. So I know Cloudflare has Miniflare, which is, I think it's a Node environment that is like, they do something to pare it down. You could obviously run it in Dino. Do you have any thoughts there, or is not something you've gone into?
No. So the one thing I should mention is AWS's edge functions are actually just normal Node.js functions. So they are the only provider that lets you run Node at the edge.
Okay.
So they're actually, we don't really have that problem. We're just going to, you know, run Node locally and it'll be fine. But for the other services like Cloudflare, they basically just let you run the exact runtime they're running at edge locally. And that'll kind of constrain it. So you have a replicated environment locally.
Mm-hmm. And probably not an issue for all that much longer, given last week Cloudflare announced that it now supports a whole bunch more of the Node APIs. Dino now has parity with Node. I know Bun. So like at a certain point, we're just going to have the Node API that will literally run anywhere. And maybe at that point, we run everything in an edge function.
Yeah, I think edge functions...
I'm just talking out my butt here. I don't really know.
Well, so the reason we haven't built edge... So we're very user-driven. So we're only really going to build stuff when people start asking for it. And no one's really asked for edge functions. And the reason is they're kind of an awkward fit in your infrastructure. The way I like to describe it is, imagine you have a string and there's different beads that are on the string. One bead is a user. The other bead is, let's say, your API. And the other bead is your database. If you start to move your API, so your functions, closer to the user, they're now further away from your database. So now round trips to your database are more expensive. So you can move the function closer to the user, but if you need to make two database calls to process that request, it might actually be slower overall. Then there's a question of moving, okay, can we just move the database closer to the user as well? Mm-hmm. But then now that database is further away from the other database nodes. So you're always going to be constrained by distributed systems problems. I think there's a lot of hype around edge right now, but I think outside of a front-end rendering stuff, there's not really much adoption and like, you know, serving back-end requests.
Interesting. That's really good to know. Can you talk a little bit about databases as well in terms of SST? What should we be using?
Yeah, so we support two databases out of the box. One is DynamoDB and the other is RDS. AWS has a serverless relational database service. So MySQL or Postgres, you can deploy it in this. It's not really serverless, like fake serverless. They'll kind of like turn it on and off and auto scale it for you. We support it. We don't recommend anyone actually use it unless they're forced to use only AWS services, because things like PlanetScale, like Neon, much better options for running relational databases in a serverless way. And then on the DynamoDB side, DynamoDB is an excellent, excellent database, and it works incredibly well with serverless environments and serverless architectures. It is a challenge to learn. There's a pattern in it called single table design. If you're coming from mostly relational databases, it's going to seem really, really weird for you. It is really great, and I think it's worth the time learning, because if you learn it, you can build systems that basically scale infinitely, and you never have to worry about database scaling ever again. But if you don't really have that burning need, then yeah, I would say go to some of these new relational database services like PlanetScale.
So people coming from non-relational databases like a Mongo context, would they be more likely to grasp some of the context, or is it its own thing entirely?
I tried it. It's freaking awful. I could not pick it up. Yeah.
So hypothetically, a Mongo developer should be able to pick it up, but I think a lot of, just given Mongo's history, like a lot of people using Mongo aren't using it the right way. But yeah, so it's, I think if you're coming from something like Cassandra or like a lot of the other maybe less popular NoSQL databases, it's very familiar and you kind of understand the constraints. There's a little bit of a misconception with NoSQL in that you can't use it for relational data. All data is relational. Like, I've never seen a non-relational data set. You can model all of it in Dynamo. It's just very different and very weird. I use it for most of my projects, but we definitely acknowledge there's a big learning curve.
That's good. We have an entire show on serverless databases where we talked about relational versus non-relational. And I ended up saying I really like the PlanetScale approach, because you can just use whatever adapter, if you know MySQL, or you can use your whatever library that you're used to using, and whatever, then you just, and local development is great. And then you can deploy the thing to a service that does make it serverless. And I thought that was a really neat approach.
Yeah, PlanScale is great. And it's kind of, we're trying to push most people down that route. We just have, because we're in the AWS world, we have a lot of like enterprise-y users that are like, we can't deploy a single thing outside AWS. Mm-hmm. So they're stuck on RDS, which I really want AWS to catch up to PlanScale there. It's, the gap is like ridiculous. It's not even close.
What about built pipelines? That's another thing that I go to Amazon and they tell you literally zip up your serverless function and press the upload button and you can upload a zip file of a thing. I'm like, seriously, where's the like git deploy automatic build type of thing? What's your solution to that?
Yeah, I'm going to give you some advice. Just never log into AWS console ever again. Like, you just don't need to. You never need to go into it. And all the information in there is wrong. So just don't go in there. So with SST, because it's an infrastructure as code tool, at least a part of it is, we know everything that your application needs to deploy. And we build everything for you. So we like build all your functions in parallel, like do that all efficiently. And we output that into a single artifact that we then deploy also for you. You can split that up if you want to like build it first and then like deploy it later. But typically people just build and deploy all at once. So our CLI, you know, SST deploy will deploy everything for you. And in terms of CI, that's actually where we make money. So we have a product called Seed. It is a build tool that is optimized for SST and other serverless projects. It just does a bunch of things that a generic build tool would never bother doing, just because we know the exact structure of your application. So a lot of our users are using that to automate their builds and do like PR environments and environments for different branches, things like that. And we'll like do stuff like monitoring all this once it's deployed. So because we know all the functions are deployed, we can add hooks to watch all the logs. And if we see something that looks like an error, we can pull out the error, structure it, kind of like how Sentry would do. So things like that. That's how we monetize our open source stuff.
Thanks.
Oh, that's cool. And would it also tell you things like how long your functions are taking to run and whatnot? Or is that more you have to get into the AWS console and look at the graphs there?
Our goal is to eventually make it so you never actually need to go there. We do have some basic observability tools right now. We haven't invested a ton in it, but eventually we do want to understand what types of things do people need to really see and surface those.
Wow. And so Seed is the company that you make money on. You pay for that. And then you guys just build SST as an open source project?
Yeah, the history of the company is a little bit funny because Seed was originally built first. So SST didn't exist. And the idea was, okay, there's people doing serverless stuff. They're using a framework called Serverless Framework. But there's not really a good CI tool for Serverless Framework. Let's build a good CI tool for that. So Seed originally, and even to this day, is really optimized for this other framework. And it was launched, it grew, and it kind of continues to grow to this day. At some point, we realized, oh, okay, even if we capture 100% of the existing serverless market, that's a good business, but it's not an incredible business. And we realized that our role actually is to make it so more people are building serverless and identify, okay, what's stopping like you guys, what's stopping, you know, any company that's being started right now from building in this way? And the answer was like, you know, AWS is really hard to use. Developer experience sucks. So that means we need to build our own framework to make this stuff more accessible. Once we grow that more, then we can come back and kind of work on Seed again and make it more optimized for SST. We're starting to hit that phase right now. I think in the second half of this year, we're going to be going back to Seed and really making it like a good product for SST.
Nice. So you're super experienced in AWS. Do you have any tips or tricks for anybody who's looks at the AWS page and has no idea what to do or where to go? Do you have any learning resources or ideas for how to pick up and understand AWS in a more complete way?
Yeah, the thing that bothers me a lot is I think you're kind of screwed from the second you sign up for AWS, because even setting up an account correctly, the default path is not, puts you on the wrong path. It puts you into setting up like IAM users and like creating credentials and like putting them in some random file. There's actually a really slick way to set all this stuff up. I made a video on it, so people can go look that up.
That's on your YouTube?
Yeah, so SST YouTube. We have a ton of resources there on one, using SST, but also just using AWS in like a sane way. I think the thing that's a little bit different about us is we're not AWS like solutions architects. Like we're not sitting here with like a bunch of certifications and doing things in this like crazy complex AWS way. We try to look at AWS and try to find like, okay, this isn't like best practice according to like the official AWS guidelines, but for most people, this is the right trade-off in accessibility and like and something that, that actually makes sense. So a lot of our content is more geared to, I'm just trying to get something done. I'm trying to be practical. And this will work for, you know, the foreseeable future. So yeah, things like setting up, it's called AWS single sign-on. Like, so you can just log in AWS or Google account and do all your credentials through that. There's a bunch of little things like that that we try to cover in our like in the YouTube content we make. It is tricky, and I think there is not a lot of good content out there for what you're asking for. There's a lot of AWS content, mm-hmm. a lot of it's outdated, and a lot of it doesn't have this like practical mindset to it. And our focus for this year is we're going to be focusing a lot more on the content stuff and helping people do this stuff a lot better. Our framework does like 90% of it because you can just start using it without really understanding some of this stuff. And over time, you kind of naturally pick it up. But like I said, like even the moment you sign up, you probably are led down the wrong path. So there's still a lot of gaps to fill.
So now's the part of the show where we talk about, basically we ask you questions. We ask everybody the types of things that are should be kind of quick one-off, easy to answer questions. So first and foremost, what kind of computer and setup are you using to work on?
Love this question. So I have a custom-built PC that I've been building and rebuilding for years. It's kind of like a ship of Theseus situation. It runs Linux. I've been like a full-time Linux user for like 10 years or so, which makes me really annoying. I'm a really annoying person.
Yeah.
Wow.
What distro do you run?
Of course, I run Arch Linux, which is the most annoying OS to run.
Up here. What text editor theme and font are you rocking?
So I use NeoVim. The theme is, I think it's called Tokyo Night. The font is Hasklug, I think, which is like, there's a font called Hasklig, and Hasklug is like a modified version of it. I found it a long time ago and don't really remember why I chose it, but here I am.
If you had to start coding from scratch today, or if you were giving somebody advice who's picking up something to work on, what types of things would you recommend?
Yeah, so it's funny because when I first started coding, I got into it through C#, which I thought was a really great entry point. It felt easy, accessible. And today, I think everyone's getting into it through TypeScript, which effectively just looks exactly like C#. You know, you can just like write C# code into a TypeScript file and it probably will work. So, you know, from my point of view, like it worked really well for me. I know a lot of people worry about, you know, as a type system in TypeScript, is that going to like overwhelm a beginner? Should I learn with JavaScript first? My memory of learning C# was I didn't really, like that all made sense to me, and having structure to what I was doing was great. So I think TypeScript it's a boring answer because I think it's probably what most people would say. I think it is a great entry point. Doing stuff in web is also great because you get to like build stuff and you get to look at it right away. I remember when I was first learning, I like loved that feedback loop of like visually looking at something. I've been loving Astro for that. It kind of reminds me of the old PHP days where I would just, you know, have a single file and I would like write stuff and I could refresh the browser and see it. I think Astro reminds me a lot of that. So I think like the mix of TypeScript and Astro is a good combination because you don't have the complexity of web dev you would normally get, but you still are kind of learning the tools you'll need once you go down that path.
What terminal and shell are you rocking?
So I use Alacrity, and the shell is ZSH. Again, just old decisions that have stuck, that worked for me for years, so haven't reevaluated.
Ain't broke, don't fix it. Yeah,
that's funny. We just talked about Alacrity. I'm pretty sure we called it Alacrity.
Yeah, we did not say it right. Yeah.
I mean, I might be saying it wrong too. these are words you never have to say out loud because you're only just reading them on the screen.
Especially a word like that, yeah.
Why do you use that terminal? Is that the best one on Linux?
So Alacrity, I think, just has a lot of energy around it. Like, it's being actively developed. It is somewhat newer. It's written in Rust, which, you know, does a lot for a lot of people. People get excited. But yeah, it performs really well. I actually don't know. I think I used to use something called URVXT, I think it was called. To be honest, terminal-wise, I can't really... So I use something called i3 in Linux. the tiling window manager, it basically puts everything on my screen into tiles, whether it's a browser or a terminal, whatever it is. Manage all of it through my keyboard, never have to use a mouse. So the terminal itself doesn't really matter because it's kind of all, like a lot of the terminal specific features you'd expect, like tabs and stuff, it's baked in at a lower layer.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. That really is the way to be. I'm starting to get into really getting my whole the entire OS essentially on the same keyboard shortcuts to do everything, and just try to lock that down. Because so often I think even like, and you know, Wes and I, we write these keyboard shortcuts. We set up these macros for like our text editor specifically, but not OS wide. I'm sure Linux is way better for that, anyways. What's something that you're excited for in the future of dev?
Future of dev. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Cloudflare because I think I'm very interested in their path. There's a lot of cloud providers or people trying to become cloud providers, but the reality is AWS is the only one that really makes any money. You can, of course, Azure makes money, but that's more just they're like monetizing the same customer base they've had for decades now. But in terms of like making real money, like having young companies start on your platform and grow into billion-dollar companies, AWS is really the only one playing that game and winning it, because you need to have a lot of primitives in place for it to really be viable for you to serve these, you know, like these public companies that are operating at a huge scale. I think Cloudflare is the first company that I'm seeing where they actually have a shot at taking the same market share. The primitives they have way fewer primitives, but they're starting serverless first. So they don't have all these, like, I'm going to call anything not serverless like a legacy model. It doesn't really make sense in the modern world. Cloudflare basically has like 10 primitives, and these 10 primitives are everything you need to build like 99% of applications. I don't think a lot of people realize this yet, but it is technically possible today. I'm really looking forward to new companies realize this and try to build like fully Cloudflare native. There's a lot of potential there, and I think I'm excited to see what that looks like.
But yeah, I've been a big Cloudflare user for a while, and I've been dipping into a lot of their both a lot of their hosting products, but also just like a lot of their pro features as well. And it's funny, whenever I ask about any of the Cloudflare features on Twitter, people are just like, it's DNS and DDoS protection. That's all they know about Cloudflare. It's like, man, little do you know that they are a massive, massive cloud company. And I think they're going to really pull up in the next couple of years, if not already have.
Yeah, I'm heavily invested in them also. So I'm just going to put that as a disclaimer. I work on AWS stuff and my hedge is my Cloudflare position in case Cloudflare dominates them.
That's smart.
Cool. All right, let's move into shameless plug. Oh no, sick picks. Do you have a sick pick for us today?
Yeah, I guess I already talked about it. So PlanetScale, which we just talked about a little bit, it is, I'm sure a lot of people have heard about it already. It is an awesome solution. I think what systems look like with and without PlanetScale, massively different in complexity. At this point, if you're starting a new service or starting a new product, you need a database, just go to PlanetScale. It's going to work for you really well and work for you for a long time. So yeah, really, really excited about what they're doing, their roadmap and everything. It's awesome. It's solving problems that I've had for like my whole career, pretty much.
Sick.
Awesome. And shameless plugs. What would you like to plug? Where can we find you?
Yeah. So, I'm mostly on Twitter. THDXR is my username. I'm working on something kind of funny, that I don't know if you maybe have seen, we announced it, like a week ago. We're working on a game show for developers. So if you guys remember HQ Trivia, you know, I would like your app would like light up once a day and there'd be like a 10-minute game show that everyone could kind of take part in live. We're trying to launch something like that. It's called Rebase TV. You can find that on Twitter or rebase.tv. We haven't like launched our first game yet, but we're like in the process of like building the app and doing all the production. And we want to have really great production quality. But yeah, I think it would just be fun to have a thing that, like, you know, the whole developer community is doing at the same time, once a week or whatever it is.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's amazing how HQ just came and went, right? Well, we'll have to share the link for that, by the way, in the show notes. But there's a really fantastic podcast that detailed the entirety of the HQ rise and fall. Boom Bust HQ trivia.
Yeah, and I think there's actually a documentary coming out about it. We had this idea last week or 2 weeks ago. So we were looking at HQ, and yeah, weirdly, coincidentally, there's a new documentary coming about it. It might already be out. I think TikTok is launching like an HQ concept as well.
It's smart. Yeah, it was. It was a lot of fun. Sick.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate all your time and insights into the world of serverless and AWS and SST. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, and if you guys are moving some of your stuff to AWS and you're understandably confused, please let me know. I kind of love helping people figure that out.
Free migrations, you say? Yeah, all right, I'll take you up on it. Cool. All right, thanks again. I'll talk to you later.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.